The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, a weekly podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeal. I'm your host, John Ross, joined today by Evan Burnick and Clark Neely of the Institute for Justice's Center for Judicial Engagement. This week we'll discuss indefensible litigation tactics by government attorneys, a Louisiana prison where the heat index in the summer frequently exceeds 100 degrees, and an unusual Fourth Amendment victory for a defendant stopped on the street and found to have contraband. Clark, kick us off.
Well, the first case is a fun one out of the Fifth Circuit. The Department of Labor here just gets spanked by the court for engaging in bad faith litigation that involved things like the lead lawyer for the Department of Labor objecting 102 times during a 45-minute deposition. The underlying case is kind of interesting, but it basically involves the Department of Labor investigation of a company that provides attendance to guard oil fields in remote areas. And the question is whether they should be considered full-time employees or independent contractors. This case really isn't about that. This case is about the way the Department of Labor conducted itself in litigation, which was, in a word, disgraceful.
Yeah, in case there was any doubt as to whether the government is prepared to defend the indefensible, this case should resolve it. The government's case fell apart very early. Notwithstanding that, it's engaged in abusive litigation tactics. It's, as Clark explains, Department of Labor's lawyer interrupts witness depositions. They file motions that are pointless. They do basically everything conceivable to prolong what should be a slam dunk case for the defendants.
Well, let's back up a bit to the actual investigation of the company. The investigator on the case conducted a wide array of misconduct. Can you tell us about that, Clark?
Yeah, apparently the Department of Labor investigator, the way he got onto this case was one of his drinking buddies was actually one of these oil field attendants and was complaining to him because he's considered to be an independent contractor and he thinks he should be classified as an employee because he would get some additional benefits. Anyway, that's the genesis of this quote-unquote investigation. But it turns out the investigator doesn't even do this kind of case. He's not trained to do this kind of case. And he violated Department of Labor regulations at every turn in the investigation, which is what Evan meant by the whole case. The whole investigation was just basically a sham. The whole case just fell apart completely. And the Department of Labor, instead of dropping it with some chagrin like a normal person would do, simply tries to brazen it out.
Yeah, I mean, so the investigator's name is Rapstein, miscalculated what the lost wages would have been, the wages that should have been paid to the employees that allegedly weren't actually paid, by several million dollars. The Department of Labor knew about this and went ahead and pushed the case anyway. So they knew that this investigator had violated internal procedures. He was completely incompetent, which isn't surprising since he's never done a case like this before. He ambushed low-level employees. He showed up unannounced at the company's headquarters, basically did everything wrong, and they pushed ahead with the case anyway.
And they inflict $1 million in litigation costs in a frivolous lawsuit, a frivolous and bungled lawsuit. And then when they lose, they refuse to pay attorney's fees to the company that they inflicted these $1 million in legal fees on. Fortunately, the Fifth Circuit was having none of it and remanded the case to the district court for a calculation of fees. The long and the short of it is the Department of Labor is definitely going to be paying for its misconduct, as it should.
When the government defends the indefensible, judges should call the government out for doing so and make them pay for it. There's a great line at the end where the judge says, look, even if this was a plausible claim at the beginning, there comes a point in time when you realize that it's not. And the government should, insofar as it's supposed to be pursuing meritorious cases, abandon it.
Okay, let's move on to another case out of the Fifth Circuit, which involves a state-of-the-art prison newly built in Louisiana. Evan, tell us about it.
Yes, a new state-of-the-art prison facility that does not have air conditioning. And the question is whether it can be cruel and unusual punishments to keep inmates in there for 23 hours a day with no air conditioning.
I think what's interesting about this case is that the court really kind of gives both sides a little bit, but neither side really comes home with a win. The district court judge looked at the case and said, yes, you're allowing it to get too hot in this prison. And so, he issued this facility-wide injunction that required the prison to keep the temperature at 88 degrees or below. And actually, the Fifth Circuit said, no, you went too far with that. This case only involves these three particular inmates who have various health issues, and that's why they have a particular problem with the heat. But the thing I think is most interesting to me about the opinion is it would have been so easy to say something like, well, I mean, we're just a court. How do we know how hot is too hot in a prison? But clearly there comes a point at which allowing a prison cell to get above a certain temperature is just cruel and inhumane. And the court wades right in and is willing to draw that line. Who knows where the line gets drawn, but somebody's got to draw it. And this court was willing to do that.
Right. You need to draw the line somewhere. And another critical feature of this decision and what makes it important and worth focusing on is how sensitive it is to the facts and the record. So the prison prison officials argued that they couldn't have been deliberately indifferent to the fact that the prison cells were getting really hot because a mere administrative complaint is not enough to put people on notice that the cells were getting too hot. Judge dived into the record, saw that not only were administrative complaints filed, but during a court-ordered monitoring period in which they tried to determine how hot these cells are, the prison officials puts water and ice on the awnings outside of the cells in order to cool them down. So they were aware that these cells were really, really hot. So the notion that the prison officials weren't aware of it was bogus, and the court called them out on it.
And, you know, not to belabor the point, but it's important for people to realize basically what happened here was the prison officials tried to cheat while they were being monitored. They tried to make the cells appear cooler than they really were because they knew they were being monitored. That's exactly the kind of government misconduct that courts need to be on the lookout for and not turn a blind eye when they see it. This panel refused to do that. In fact, called the government out for its misconduct. And that didn't result in a complete, you know, clean sweep for the prisoners who were challenging the policy, but it was a great example of engaged judging.
Okay, moving on to the next case, which comes out of the Seventh Circuit. Evan.
So this case involves what's called a Terry stop. A Terry stop is a pat-down that police officers can do if they have reasonable suspicion that somebody is armed and dangerous. A 911 caller specifically describes somebody, says that he's committing a burglary. Police come to the scene, and they pat this guy down. And they not only pat him down, they handcuff him, and then they go into his backpack. And the question is whether the initial call, the reasonable suspicion that this guy might have been armed and dangerous, justifies searching his backpack.
Clark, what do the courts say?
No, and it's really interesting the amount of theories and facts that the court has to go through to get to that result. There's all different kinds of ways that the government could perform a search. They could have consent, which they claimed that they got in this case. The court found, nope, that was not credible. They could be exigent circumstances. One of the arguments the government made was that the pat-down occurred right outside of a school where these guys were about to walk into the school. The court rejected that because basically the circumstances were not truly exigent. And so basically what we get is a very interesting kind of seminar in Fourth Amendment law as the court works through all of these theories that the government asserts for why it was okay to look inside the backpack without a warrant. And ultimately, the court comes to the conclusion, no, it wasn't. There was no exception that applies. And interestingly enough, the government actually waived what appears to have been its strongest argument, which is that actually they had a sufficient basis to arrest the individual in this case. They disclaimed that and said, no, this is just a Terry stop. We were just patting the guy down. He was not under arrest at the time.
And the court says, you know what, that might have been a plausible theory, but you can't rely upon it now, and we're not going to litigate your case for you. So the court refuses to help the government out.
And for the record, the guy who was patted down didn't actually commit a burglary. He, in fact, went to a friend's house or someone that he knew, and that was confirmed to the police before the pat-down or after?
I don't think it was confirmed before the pat-down was done. They later found it out. But the critical point here, and you know what this case really rests upon, is the guy has been handcuffed. They've patted him down. They found nothing. Any reason that they might have had to detain him has now disappeared. And then they decide to search in his bag. And the court said, no, you can't do that.
Yeah, and we should emphasize one point that the court ends with, which is really interesting, and that is the court makes a specific point that just the fact that he was carrying a gun does not necessarily make him a suspected criminal. The court notes that basically there is now a constitutional right to own a gun, and in Wisconsin there's a constitutional right to carry that gun, or at least if you have a permit. And so the court goes out of its way to point out that simply being found with a gun is not evidence of criminal wrongdoing and does not provide by itself a basis to arrest somebody on suspicion of being armed and dangerous. And so basically what I think the Seventh Circuit is doing here is going out of its way to say, look, we have to kind of reorient ourselves. And when I say we, I'm talking about prosecutors, judges, and defense lawyers about what really constitutes probable cause when somebody has a gun.
Yeah, so this is a legitimately challenging case, but you don't lose your Fourth Amendment rights by exercising your Second Amendment rights. The court engaged in a fact-sensitive, engaged analysis and came to the correct conclusion.
Okay, that concludes our show. We thank you for listening and hope you'll tune in next week for more cutting-edge constitutional analysis from the Center for Judicial Engagement. And so until next time, this is John Ross from the Institute for Justice, advocating that you get engaged.